G'day and welcome to Roaming with Lil. My name is Lil Deverell. I'm an orientation and mobility specialist interested in anything to do with functional vision, orientation and mobility, and the research that helps us to do our job better. In O&M, it can be easy to overlook the O and just deal with the M, because mobility with its gait styles, mobility aids, steps and slopes seems quite tangible. We might focus on vision, but in O&M we know that a person's clinical vision does not predict their travel capability in everyday places. Orientation is trickier to understand because it is the largely invisible work of the mind. The O&M profession is a bit inclined to assume everyone can learn orientation to new places if we only do our job well enough. But this isn't the case. The problem is that we haven't had reliable tools or standardised methods to measure a person's spatial cognition, to predict their orientation skills, and know how long to persist with someone who's having trouble. In the 1980s, neuropsychologist Ian Stewart developed the Stewart Tactile Maps test and its sidekick, the 3D Constructions test, for his PhD study. Unfortunately, the tests and their results were buried in the literature, but since the 1990s, I've had the privilege of watching Ian administer these tests when I referred clients to him for neuropsych assessment who were having trouble with orientation. The brilliant thing about these tests is that they take vision out of the equation. Everyone wears a blindfold to do the tests, and the results do predict a person's capacity for mental mapping in everyday environments. These neuropsych assessments had such a profoundly helpful impact on my own O&M practice that I asked Ian to teach me to use the tests myself for my own PhD study. Then I worked with Ian to create a commercial version of the Stewart Tactile Maps test, which is now available to the international O&M profession. And today I'm talking with Dr. Ian Stewart about the origins of the Stewart Tactile Maps test. So I want to welcome you, Ian. Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of your career as a neuropsychologist? Where did you begin?
As you can tell from my age, it started a long time ago. I was at university, I was doing a master's degree. I was supposed to actually avoid the master's and go straight to a PhD, but my supervisor heard my presentation of what was going to be a PhD at that time, and she was so antagonistic to it that she refused me permission to go on, and I had to immediately write it up as a master's thesis, and I had no money and I had no job, and things were pretty grim. So I applied for a job in the health department, mental health. The guy, he said, look, there's a job going at a place called the Neuropsychiatric Centre. Yes, I got the job, and I ended up in this unit that Dr. John Lloyd had just started. I think it was about 1978. Previously, it was the neurosurgical unit. They were used to treat various mental health conditions in the 50s and 60s, was psychosurgery. I don't think people want to think very much about what went on in those days. They used to do the prefrontal leucotomies for the treatment of depression. And if you were depressed, what they did was the leucotome was inserted into the brain, and it sort of destroyed all the connections between the frontal lobes and the back part of the brain. The horrible thing about it was that they thought it was just cutting connections, but it was actually destroying the area of the brain that's related to impulse control and to personality. I mean, the story of those leucotomies, the brain injuries that they did, were horrifying. You read some of the early cases, they used to treat schizophrenia, and they used to treat people in the office. They would insert a probe just into the corner of the eye, and they would wiggle it around, and that would go into the brain and it would affect the frontal lobes.
Slosh things around a little bit in there.
Slosh things around a bit. And it was horrifying times. We're going back into the 50s and 60s there. By the time that the 60s came about, people were waking up to it. What was happening. The reason I'm saying all that is when I arrived at this unit in 1978, Dr. John Lloyd had created it as an assessment unit for neuropsychiatry, which means that he was looking at cases of psychiatry and cases in neurology, cases that span both of those. And he was a really extremely clever clinician, one of the best that you would come across. You needed people who were in the middle. So it could be a neurologist who worked in the field of psychiatry, or it could be a psychiatrist who worked in the field of neurology. I think it's become a really fairly common area of practice now, neuropsychiatry, whereas in 1978, I think it was only in its early days. Neuropsychology was also just beginning at that stage. I'd been taught by Kevin Walsh, who started off neuropsychology at the University of Melbourne. That was all very exciting stuff in those days. One of the other people that was in the unit was a man by the name of Dr. Stefan Sokolowski, and he was a neurosurgeon. I think he was appointed on the idea that he was going to do the neurosurgical operations, these prefrontal operations, but he refused to do them. They realised that I knew nothing about the brain. Stefan took me under his wing, really, and he started to teach me everything that he could in the time. He had a friend who actually was a pathologist at Mont Park, and we used to go along every week and do dissections of the brain. I was tremendously fortunate because he knew so much. I never realised how fortunate and privileged I'd been to have this contact with this man who knew so much.
So how did you first become interested in spatial cognition?
The master's thesis was on Piaget's thought, and I came up with an idea that said, look, one of the central aspects of Piaget is the transition that the child goes through from pre-conservation to conservation, that is the ability to see when you move certain pieces of equipment around and things like that, transformations. The child is able to understand transformations in a way they couldn't previously. And that put me onto the track of spatial awareness. Piaget is all about spatial stuff.
So the notion that a tall, thin glass of water might hold the same volume as a short, fat glass of water.
That's the one. You are.
I read the pictures in the textbooks, Ian.
But I was interested in number conservation, which means that when you put an array of counters in front of a child and then you spread them apart or bring them closer, the pre-conservation child thinks that there's more counters when you spread them out than there are when you move them closer. So my thesis, I said, this is the development of mental imagery because the child is able to imagine the transformation of a mental image from an angle of 45 degrees to 90 degrees. So I tried to establish that.
When doing after-school childcare, I was playing Monopoly with a six-year-old who insisted on having all his change in $1 notes and $5 notes because that gave him more money.
Yes, there you go. At that time, it must have been in the 70s, I was starting to read the literature then, and I read the papers on HM, who is a very, very well-known person. His name is Henry Mollison. He was a classic case. At that time, they were starting to operate on people for epilepsy. They would do operations on the hippocampus. They would remove some of the cortex and that would relieve the epilepsy often. It often helped. But in the case of HM, a doctor removed both the left and the right hippocampus from this guy who was an epileptic. And the stunning thing about that was that he lost all capacity for new learning. Life for him was only what he'd learned from the past. He could remember nothing from 1 minute to the next. It was the most profound disorder, and it absolutely shook the whole neurology field. And what it showed was that the hippocampus is hugely associated with memory. One of the biggest studies that was done was by Brenda Milner in 1965, and she devised the button maze. When she gave it to groups of people who'd had various lesions in the brain, Some were in the frontal lobes, some were in the parietal lobes, and some were in the hippocampus. And what she found was that HM, the man with no hippocampi, had no recollection of the pathway. It's a 10 by 10 button maze where you find your way by pressing the button. The light lights up when you're on the right track and you get a buzzer when it doesn't. And so you find your way through this path. And this is a pathway that's probably, you know, got 10 or 12 segments to it. So this was a very influential paper. And it showed also that people with frontal lobe disorders on this test often acted in a very impulsive manner too. And there was also one case, I think, which interested me, which was a woman who had a parietal disorder, lesions to the parietal lobes, and she was unable to remember the path either. So this was very influential, and particularly when, at the same time, there was another woman by the name of Suzanne Corkin who devised a tactile version of this map maze. And her tactile version, she gave it to the same patients that Brenda Milner had done. And she found the same sort of thing happening in the tactile domain. So spatial awareness wasn't necessarily visual. It could be tactile. That was the message I took from it. The paper was in 1965 and I was reading in 1978 or 9. Because of this interest that I had in these papers that I was reading, I started to get interested in blindness and people without vision. And I was talking to Betty Hill, who was at Royal Talbot at the time. She was a speech pathologist there. And she said, look, why don't you go and talk to Don Villander over the road at Guide Dogs? He was very interested in all the brain stuff. And he was trying to set up the model for orientation and mobility based on brain injury. He set up this entire unit, and Betty Hill, she was his guide, and she eventually came over and she worked there. So Betty introduced me to Don Villander, and Don said, you must come and start seeing these clients. And he threw me in the deep end. I started walking with the clients, and he showed me what they do and what they wouldn't do and what they couldn't do, all from the O&M perspective. It was an absolute eye-opener to me because I'd never thought of spatial understanding in terms of practicality. It was all stuff in books and glasses of water and counters that changed. And all of a sudden, I saw how practical it was. I went through all the tests that they were using for blind people in those days, and there were a lot of tests, but none of them actually were of any use. They were all about braille reading and quite complex tests of intelligence and nothing to do with orientation and mobility. In order to be able to do these assessments, I had to think of a way to perform a realistic assessment. So I was reading extensively in all of the literature about that. Arthur Benton devised the Benton visual retention test, and he devised a constructional test, which I was very impressed with. This was visual, and it was a method of assessing spatial awareness and understanding in the visual system, but not in the tactile. I was thinking about all these things, and one day I just thought, you know, when people are doing the tactile version of the Milner maze, and when they are doing the visual version, Suzanne Corkin found there was a correlation between the two. So I thought, what do they have in common? Well, this sort of idea came to me. It has to be the movement of the arm. There's nothing else. If you've got vision and you've got tactile, both represented strongly in these tests, the only thing they have in common is that there's a movement of the arm. That was the beginning of how I worked on that tactile maps test. I was walking with Amanda in the city one day and I saw this guy who was actually manipulating bits of wire and he was making animals out of it. I thought, oh, I can use that. So that was where I got the idea of using the wire shape. That all merged with the PhD. And I also thought, well, Benton's 3D constructions test, I can do that in the tactile version as well. So those were my two tests. Then, because I was interested in all this, I went to Burwood School for the Blind and I saw the principal there, Peter Evans, and he was terrific. He said, yes, come along. And he loved the idea of doing research. And I got involved there, and Gillian Gale was running the assessment centre. She obviously thought what I could do would help her. So I started to do assessments for their assessment centre. A child would come in and we do a detailed assessment from every point of view, from the educational point of view, from the social point of view, and from the neuropsych point of view. By this time, I was starting to feel confident about all the tests that I was giving. I started to develop a lot of clinical skills, and through the influence of Don Volander at Guide Dogs and through Gillian Gale at Burwood School for the Blind, I was just helped by so many people. It was all sort of coming together. One day I went to see a boy. He was at a private school. Gillian and I went out there to interview him. And as we were walking along, he said, if you look over there to the left, you'll see the gymnasium. And across to the right is the main school building. And this is the way we go down here to see my classroom and things like that. And this boy had never had sight at all.
And yet he knew his way.
He was absolutely confident. And another boy I saw once, I went out to his house. I went into the house and he's rummaging in the cupboard. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm just getting my rollerblades. He got his rollerblades out and I didn't stop him. Off he went. He lived on a crescent and he could rollerblade on the street. And that was what he was doing. And I thought, my goodness, there's some very high functioning people. But then I also started to see people who O&M instructors were having difficulty with. Some of them had been having instruction that went on for weeks and months and months, but the clients were not getting any better. They were still disoriented in space. Often they'd find their way in their home, but take them out and put them into a new environment, which it was at Guide Dog because they were residential at the time. Mm. Put those people into
foreign territory, really.
Yes, and just put them out there, and all of a sudden their deficits became alarmingly obvious. Some of them were so severe that they had no idea of where they were. If they walked more than one turn, they were completely lost and couldn't find their way back. And he and I did a study on one of the girls he was looking after there. He'd been training her for quite a while. We made a huge effort to teach her over a period of 3 weeks, and she learned absolutely nothing. And she performed really poorly on both of the tests. That could see that the 3D constructions was the fundamental. When the blind child was attempting to put two or three blocks together in a spatial array, they were completely unable to do it. Some of these children who had very severe problems, normal language, absolutely normal in verbal intelligence, but totally bewildered by space.
I remember asking you to assess someone who had been coming to camps at the residence for some 10 years. She continued to get lost on an L-shaped route, despite that practice over many years. And she was game to do some construction work in her downtime using Duplo. And she worked very hard at it. And it took her 2 hours to work out that two rectangular blocks could make a square. And yet she had the most beautiful social skills and worked out how to navigate socially. So in lieu of mental mapping, I saw her walk to the end of the corridor, open the door, listen for where the people were, walk directly up to them and engage with them, reconnect with her friends, and then go with them wherever they wanted to go. So she'd learned to do her navigation socially without needing to do mental mapping, but building these lovely relationships with other people and trusting them as travel companions. And it was a very, very effective strategy for her.
Yes. But as we know, put her on a street crossing and say, now, where are you going to go now to cross the road? How are you going to cross the road? How are you going to evaluate your situation? It would be very difficult.
It's very difficult to act with intention if you don't know where you are. And that's where things like GPS with sequenced audio instructions using Google Maps, for example, where you say, where am I? Key in where you want to go, and the app itself tells you what to do in what order. They're just a gift for these people who can't map it in their head.
I mean, I haven't even come to grips with any of that, but it's just astounding, isn't it?
Mm.
The difference it must make.
Mm. So technology has so many non-spatial functions now, and sometimes they're combined with spatial functions. But when I compare notes with someone who's not so keen on mental mapping, when we talk about Google Maps, I'll be saying, yes, I want the big picture view. I need to know where I am in Melbourne, just so that when I start driving, I'm not having to watch the map or listen to the audio. I just vague out with the audio instructions and miss it and take a creative route. And yet my daughter, who much prefers that sequenced audio instruction, she's hanging on to the sequence because she finds it much more confusing to make sense of the big picture. So it's brilliant that these new technologies are offering multiple ways in to wayfinding.
Yes.
So that people aren't dependent on good orientation skills to be competent travellers without vision.
It gives them their lives back, I'm sure.
It widens their life space and their roaming range, and they can travel with confidence into unknown places. This interest in O&M helped to put flesh on the bones of the interest you already had in spatial cognition. You were also working at Royal Talbot during this time with people who'd had acquired brain injury from stroke, traumatic brain injury. Did you use the tests in the hospital system?
I did. When I came to do the PhD, I had one group, which was the congenitally blind group, and I had 32 subjects in that group. I had a group of people with specific focal brain damage to the parietal area and the congenitally blind group and controls. So I compared those three groups with tactile constructions, putting together the blocks or the Duplo. You've got to have the ability to integrate the sense of space. You've got to have a sense of where the joints are, the angles that you're looking for, how the whole thing works together. And what I discovered from general reading was that the parietal lobe was responsible. People with parietal damage had fragmentation in the sense of space. So these people were also struggling to put together their sense of space in exactly the same way that those blind children, your clients and mine, we had parallels in people who had bilateral parietal lobe damage. One client comes to mind who had bilateral parietal damage. This man had been an engineer, a very talented man, but he was unable to find his way from one side of a room to another. He had no spatial awareness whatsoever. And these things were all coming together to give me this sort of model of how the brain works.
So the key to your PhD study was really creating a couple of tests that didn't require vision, that enabled you to explore spatial cognition and compare spatial cognition, taking vision out of the equation.
Yes, yes. And so I explored it in a group of people who had suffered parietal lobe damage, in a group of people who were congenitally blind, which was an exploration, and a group of control people who had no problems of any nature, of spatial difficulty.
What are you working on now?
Oh, well, 2019, I had a paper published. I'd done an experiment while I was at Royal Talbot, another experiment, which I decided to write up some 15 years later. That was really looking at the hippocampus and memory. But now I realised that the gap in all of this, from a neurophysiology point of view, the cell biology of the parietal lobe I wasn't aware of what was happening in that field. So I've started reading and I really discovered how far these people have gone, because the model that they've been working on for most of the hippocampal stuff is done with implanted electrodes in rats. So they put in an electrode into the brain, and then when the rat does a certain action, this cell will fire. So when the rat's learning a task, then the cell is firing. The same applies with the parietal lobe. When you implant an electrode in the parietal lobe, area 5 in the parietal lobe, it's mainly about reaching movements, the ability to move your hand forward to reach a particular object in front of you. So if you reach forward to pick up anything, any sort, small object, the reaching movement is recorded in the cells in area 5 of the parietal lobe. And these people have been recording this information. Probably it started in the 1970s, and they've made huge gains up until the present day. What I'm writing at the moment is I'm identifying this spatial coordinate system in the brain, which functions without any vision whatsoever. And it's very hard to disentangle the effects of vision because the visual system is immensely powerful. But it depends on the proprioceptive system in many ways to create a model of where things are in our world around us. If you have to go to the toilet at night, you know, or you're finding your way somewhere when you haven't got vision, you use this spatial system.
Mm. And it keeps you on track, even if your visual information is skewed or dulled or not there at all.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm. What this is showing us is that there's a whole lot happening in spatial cognition that's absolutely not dependent on vision. At the same time, we've had vision researchers understand that there are multiple pathways for processing visual information, some more conscious than others, and that one of the really important feeds from the visual cortex is up into the parietal lobe.
You know, the two work together, but vision, we're overwhelmed by vision, aren't we? To such an extent that some people have no concept that there's anything else but vision.
Becomes the primary way to interpret the world.
Mm. Absolutely.
The other thing that's become apparent to me since exploring spatial cognition with people who have low vision is just how effectively people with poor spatial cognition can use vision. So being able to see a street name means that you can follow instructions that involve a sequence of street names.
Well, that's absolutely right, because if you use the language of space, if you say, I turn right here, you may not have a mental image of turning right, but you know that you've got a right hand and you can turn right. You can do that by using the verbal instructions. That uses verbal memory as well as your verbal logic and your whole reasoning capacity. So it's a huge support for anyone who's travelling.
One of the things that became apparent to me in using the Stuart Tactile Maps test in my own PhD study was a thing that I have called ambient vision. And people who have really good mental mapping skills with only very little low vision, might be light perception only, have this facility that I call ambient vision. But people without strong mental mapping skills do not. So two people with light perception only can come out of the optometry clinic with a fairly bleak clinical measure of what they can see, but functionally perform incredibly differently because the person with strong mental mapping skills is putting together visual fragments, specular reflections, patches of contrast with light and dark, an awareness that the curtains might be open and that the window's over there.
Yes.
They can map these fragments, none of which is entirely recognisable in its own right, But these things become recognisable because of their spatial context, their situation in relation to other visual fragments and the sorts of things that you would expect to find. So a person with good mental mapping skills maps these little jigsaw puzzle pieces, firstly in an approximate place, but then more precisely. And the process of motion parallax actually helps that. So with motion parallax, people are moving and using that movement to make rapid comparisons between the relative positions of things.
For those people, the ability to represent space is actually highly developed. Their spatial awareness system is functioning at a very high level. And so any spatial coordinates that they're given are immediately put into context, all in relation to each other. Everything relates to everything. And they can do it all the time. Once they've got it, once they've put together a map like that, every new time they travel that route is confirming, testing, and confirming.
So a person with strong mental mapping skills, I found in my study, could move around the room and through spaces to within an inch of crashing into things sometimes, making you think that they have so much more vision than they actually do. Clinically, they don't have a lot. What they're doing is using their interpretation of those visual fragments with their best guess in context to create what is actually quite a rich multidimensional map to use to access the world. And they just crash less often. They move more efficiently, even though clinically they have the same vision as the person with poor mental mapping skills. Now, the person with poor mental mapping skills will see something, but because they can't do those spatial comparisons, can't work out what the something might be, it's like someone keeps shaking up the jigsaw puzzle pieces in the box. So that person has to use a lot more hit and miss when it comes to traveling through the environment. And their travel is never quite graceful. It's never quite fluent. It's always just that little bit clunky, even with a lot of experience.
It brings to mind when I was at Burwood School for the Blind, one of the congenitally blind young men there, he'd been at Burwood School for the Blind for 10 years from about the age of five, and he was about 14 when I saw him. When he came out of his classroom, he had to go to the reception desk, which was down a corridor, turn right, and there you were. But he would come to the door of his classroom. He would attend down to the left and down to the right, and he would not know which way to turn. And that was after 10 years of doing the same thing day after day after day after day. Now, if he's one of your people who are struggling, he's not going to be helped by anything in the environment, is he? Whereas someone who has a very attentive memory, a retentive memory, logical capacity, but this primary, really very quick and retentive memory for space.
Yes, it's making those instant comparisons about the relative position of things, how far apart they are, what the angles are between them. It's all the triangulation that surveyors do with their measurements, with their theodolites. We're doing in our minds with pinpoints of visual reference points. So the difference between the difference for someone with poor spatial cognition who has some low vision is whether or not they can recognise in its own right what the person is looking at. If they're seeing only a fragment of it or one characteristic and cannot recognise the thing from that characteristic, then it's not useful for them because they're unable to plot the reduced information and compare it spatially with other things. But that person with poor spatial cognition, if they can get a glimmer of something that is quite unique and recognize the thing for what it is, then it can become useful for them because they can use it as a beacon to move towards and then move from that beacon to the next, you know, thing that is recognizable visually, and therefore not have to map these things in spatial relationship. and they're taking three-dimensionality into a linear sequence, leapfrogging from one thing to the next.
This boy that I told you about that stood at the door and didn't know which way to go, when he did the 3D constructions test, one bit of it involved putting a long rod, which was about, you know, 3 or 4 inches long, and it had to be angled on top of a rectangular piece. He could not orient that rod correctly. He had no capacity to do it.
Despite being able to use both hands to make comparisons and,
as much as he wanted, he had as much time, but he had no idea. I think it's very uncommon. That severity is uncommon, but it needs to be recognised for what it is when you see it.
My own research indicated that 85% of people are doing mental mapping very effectively and 15% are not. It's not that they can't do mental mapping, it's just that they need so many repetitions to bed down a mental map that it becomes not a very feasible strategy unless the person is actually accessing that area, like home or the school classroom, really, really frequently.
15% then. It's a high number of your group. They all had some form of visual impairment.
They all had degrees of vision impairment, and there was no correlation between their visual status and their Stuart Tactile Maps results. So you don't need vision to develop mental mapping skills. And your vision does not predict your capability with mental mapping. So you take vision out of the equation, and I have talked to people in the university context and they say, yes, I get lost all the time when I'm out driving. Whip out the Stuart Tactile Maps test, and sure enough, there are fully sighted, brilliant people who have incredibly poor mental mapping skills, but with vision, it is masked.
How interesting.
Similarly, I've used the Stuart Tactile Maps test to assess a lot of O&M specialists and have found O&M specialists who score surprisingly low as well. And I had thought that you must have brilliant orientation skills to be an O&M specialist. And yet here are people teaching clients how to get around the world using alternative methods themselves than mental mapping. My first thought was, how can you do your job? And then I started to genuinely ask the question, how do you do your job? And that's what led me to realize that there are so many strategies that you can use to navigate the world that don't rely on this deeply known sense of spatially where things are in the world. You don't have to do mental mapping to get around.
It gets more complicated, though, from my point of view, because if you say you've got a parietal disorder, that is profound if you've got that. But if you've got normal parietal functioning, but if your right hippocampus, the part that creates permanent memories from the spatial information, if that's damaged, then you get a person who has good sense of where things are in space, but they find it difficult to elaborate a bigger and wider and more comprehensive. So these people would present like the ones you're describing. These are people who have a good sense of space, but who are unable to use their memory to elaborate it into a more complex system.
I think there's a lot more observation and research and thinking and conversations to be had, I think, with people who have vision but some difficulty with spatial functioning to explore at a functional level what they're doing. And I think it's such a great opportunity in the O&M field to have those conversations, respectful conversations about very different ways of navigating the world, and see if we can work out from a functional perspective what's happening and bring those questions back to clinicians and researchers who can use the available tools to explore those very nuanced ways of accessing the world.
Yeah. The other thing that comes to mind when you're talking about people doing these tests, you're looking at behaviour, and behavior can be affected by all sorts of mental state, stress and anxiety. To have someone like yourself evaluating their spatial awareness might be enough in some cases to make them really to lose their sort of sense of confidence.
So we need to tread lightly.
I think everything has to be confirmed. It's the one thing that I've learned in clinical work. You have to confirm in their behaviour. Is there any other test that you can use that will support it? Is there any other way that you can explore these people? It's so striking when you see a person having difficulties. When a person is blind and is struggling and doing their best, the failures are more profound. I think you see them more obviously. All I'm saying is that I wouldn't want people to think that the test can be enough in itself.
No, it's a screening thing.
First of all, and it may alert you to a possibility.
So always worth following up with a neuropsych assessment with someone who has a low score on the Stuart Tactile MAPS test.
Well, I mean, the trouble is, at the moment, the O&M people know more about it than the neuropsych people do. But having said that, if you have someone who you think has got a severe problem, then you can confirm it by observing their travel, by looking into their history. How does their history fit together with this, you know?
And finding appropriate conversation partners who are professionals, who have some idea of what they're looking at, talking with the other people in the client's life,
yes,
who have their own observations to make.
Absolutely. Family know exactly what their child can do and can't do. And often they haven't been believed by others.
One of the responses from parents that I've had more than once after bringing a client to you for assessment and identification of spatial dysfunction is relief. The parents are just so relieved to understand the specificity of the problem that the child is experiencing. It doesn't mean they won't be able to do maths at school or write an essay or things like that. Those areas of the brain are working. This issue of spatial dysfunction has very specific implications for orientation and mobility and the ways to learn how to navigate the world. So it is with some relief that parents greet that kind of diagnosis or confirmation.
When I was at Burwood, as part of the assessment, the team would talk to the parents about what was happening. And you're right. I mean, a lot of parents, because they didn't have an understanding of what was going on, they were upset by it.
Mm.
I think it seemed to help to know that this is part of their condition or, you know. Mm.
And when you can name the problem accurately, you can trace its implications more accurately and it helps to avoid catastrophizing.
Yes, absolutely. It does normalise.
Look, Ian, I want to thank you for having a conversation with me today about the origins of the Stuart Tactile MAPS test. Mm. I am so proud to be able to take your ideas from the 1980s that somehow got a bit buried in the literature, even though they were manifest in your own professional practice, and make this amazing professional assessment for spatial cognition available to O&M specialists and guide dog mobility instructors to our international profession to use.
I'm so thrilled at that, Lil. I could never have done it myself. And I'm just so thrilled that you're doing it because this will help to keep it going.
And hopefully, Ian, other people will use the test and critique it and we stand on the shoulders of giants. Mm. Let's look for something bigger and better in the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, I won't be there.
It's a delight to talk with you today. Thank you, Ian.
Yeah, thanks very much, Neil.
You can find a summary of this episode in the PowerPoint on my website, www.lildeverell.net/resources, including references for the various publications we mentioned. Ian's original paper refers to his assessment tool as the Tactual MAPS test, but I hung his name on the title in 2012 in honour of Ian. You can order the Stuart Tactile MAPS test on my website. The instruction manual includes plenty of ideas about what to do if you do identify spatial dysfunction, including alternative ways to navigate without needing mental mapping. Well, it's time to ponder again the strategies that you use to stay orientated as you keep roaming.